This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beach on ABC Radio Australia. Today, the growing talk of China's influence in the Pacific's now having an impact on the domestic politics of Solomon Islands as the country gears up for its national election. Will the next government switch diplomatic allegiance from Taiwan?
A lot of our exports or our business dealings with China and our diplomatic ties with Taiwan, I think it puts our government in some kind of awkward position.
Also coming up, the head of PNG's Defence Force responds to soldiers who took to the street yesterday claiming they've still not been paid money owed to them from last year's APEC summit.
It's just a show of force to influence the government to fast-track the payment of outstanding APEC allowances. It's not acceptable. We will deal with them under the court of military discipline.
We'll have more on that story and much more coming up here on Pacific Beach. Good morning, I'm Catherine Grau. Thanks for your company. First, though, China's growing influence in the region is starting to have an impact on the domestic politics of Solomon Islands as the country prepares for its national election in early April. Questions are now being raised about whether the next government could switch the Solomon's diplomatic allegiance from Taiwan to China. Despite rumours going around, many political parties say that they are sticking by Taiwan, for the time being at least, as Evan Wasuka reports.
The countdown is on and Solomon Islands has roughly a month and a half to go to the April the 3rd national elections. 14 political parties are contesting the elections. In previous polls, foreign policy has not been a major issue in the campaigning period. But this time around, one issue has popped up early: China. Solomon Islands has long been the largest political ally of Taiwan in the Pacific. But amid China's growing influence in the region, Honiara's relationship with Taipei is firmly in the spotlight.
A lot of our exports or our business dealings with China and our diplomatic ties with Taiwan, I think it puts our government in some kind of awkward position.
Dr. Gordon Nanao is a political science lecturer at the University of South Pacific in Fiji.
It goes back to government, the new government that will be formed this year to decide on, you know, which way the relationships go after the election.
John Usuramo is the president of the Democratic Alliance Party, the lead party in the government led by the caretaker Prime Minister Rick Ho. A recent newspaper report said his party would support a switch of allegiance, but Mr. Usuramo says that's not the case. He says if his party gets back into power, it will review the country's foreign policy.
In order to satisfy everyone, we said, okay, we'll have a review of that particular, our relationship with Taiwan, but that doesn't mean that we are going to break the relationship with Taiwan. Taiwan is very important to Solomon Islands.
Mr. Usuramo says his party is sticking with Taiwan, but the door is still open for China, but in the area of trade. The Solomon Islands Democratic Party and its leader, Matthew Wale, says they'll be following the same path.
We will be seeking trade delegation status with the People's Republic of China and continue to maintain our relationship with the Republic of China on Taiwan. That's our position.
While the official position of the Solomon Islands government has been to recognize Taiwan, political parties say there's been plenty of lobbying by China for a change. Mr. Usuramo says it's something of an open secret in Honiara.
We know that a number of political parties have had dialogue with certain individuals that have come here to the Solomon Islands as well as have traveled to China.
Peter Boyers is the president of the Kandare Party. He says he's aware of discussions about China taking place in political circles.
I'm not sure whether it's something that it's driven from inside the country or whether it's driven outside, but obviously there's been some engagement with some political parties on the mainland or One China policy, yeah.
The Kandare Party doesn't have a set foreign policy. Mr. Boyers says they'll be making their decision once they get into government.
I don't think there's a country in the region, or especially on the Melanesian Pacific Rim, that hasn't gone with China already. I suppose we're the last standing. Whatever happens, I believe it needs to be responsible and, of course, conducive to our country's need.
Dr. Nanao from USP says some of the discussion about China has also been fueled by the growing frustration by Solomon Islanders over the use of the Rural Constituency Development Fund, which in the past has been predominantly funded by Taiwan.
The discussion this election is mostly around how much money the MPs received from, you know, from Taiwan, and maybe the shift to China, how much are we expecting from that? That kind of discussion, it's mostly to do with the control of funds that are coming in from donors like Taiwan.
But Mr. Boyers from the Kandare Party says for all the talk on the issue, he doesn't think the Taiwan versus China debate will weigh heavily on people's minds come polling day.
I would think that the voters wouldn't worry not too worried about it, because they're living in a situation where they're still in need of services and good infrastructure. So, you know, the average voter doesn't look at it in a national sense. They're looking at it as within their own jurisdiction or constituency.
It's Peter Boyers. He's the president of the Kandare Party in Solomon Islands. That report from Evan Wasuka. A recent ruling in Vanuatu's Supreme Court that found that the gifting of land to departmental staff by the then Lands Minister, Stephen Kalsakol, was unlawful. That ruling's being hailed as the most important court decision since 14 of Vanuatu's MPs were jailed for corruption. Now, that land will have to be handed back to the state, and the courts also told Mr. Kalsakol that he must reimburse more than 50 staff for the costs that they incurred in the registration and granting of leases. As Richard Ewart reports, while the judgment has obvious implications for future land deals in Vanuatu, a key government advisor says it also sends a clear message to the rest of the Pacific.
By any standards, it was an extraordinary act of generosity, a minister gifting land to the staff in his department. And government legal advisor Siobhan McDonnell from the Australian National University says it didn't matter where you were on the pecking order.
This was all the staff from the director level down to cleaners who would clean the offices on the weekend. Every one of those staff members were gifted parcels of all of the remaining green spaces in Port Vila and Luganville.
A subsequent assessment by the Valuer General established that in many cases the gifted land had been undervalued and the departmental staff had paid nothing for it. And with a leadership code stating clearly that no one should benefit from public office, the current Minister for Lands, Alfred Maho, says the court has made the right decision.
For the staff and even the ministry itself, it's a big relief for us. And also it's a warning, as we call it, to the staff and department from the different departments to ensure that the near land dealings in the future.
It was in 2012 that the then Lands Minister, Ralph Reganvanu, set out to get back the land that had been disposed of illegally, and Dr. McDonnell came on board as a legal advisor. More than 6 years on, and the desired outcome has been achieved, and the court's decision will clearly resonate in Vanuatu. But Dr. McDonnell believes there are major implications for other Pacific countries, and she says there is a need for land deals all over the region to be held up for proper scrutiny.
I've worked a lot in Honiara, for example. There is a long-held practice of politicians gifting land to friends, to investors, and they go legally unchallenged. It means they're much more likely to occur again. There's a whole series of land deals happening in Fiji at the moment that civil society are questioning because they don't think they're in the public's interest. There are a whole series of land deals that have taken place in Port Moresby that have been heavily criticised on a similar basis.
And Minister Maho says what the judge in this case has done is listen to what the people of Vanuatu have said about the fraudulent deals.
Really, it is a fraud indeed, given the public repercussions and comments over the media that they want all this state property back, and that's what the court has decided. So we are getting the necessary steps now to ensure that we can't get these land leases, the existing lease. We have to re-register them and then have it back as the state property, and we will ensure that no one takes it under our nose in the near future.
Dr. McDonnell says the Supreme Court's ruling on the gift of land doesn't carry the same level of significance as the corruption case that led to the jailing of 14 MPs, but she says it's not far off.
I don't think it's as significant as the bribery case, but I do think it's incredibly significant in terms of making sure that the public service is reminded that it needs to act in the interests of the public. And that's not just about the acts of public servants, it's also about the past acts of ministers of land. It's this idea that politicians can use those portfolios for their own self-interest rather than for the public good.
So some $10 million in leases on green space in Port Vila and Luganville must be returned to public ownership, but there's still more land, around $4 million worth, that was gifted and then unsold. Minister Maho says it won't be easy, but the intention now is to get that land back too and ensure that all future land deals are transparent.
We have a cultural tradition over here in Vanuatu whereby keep things in the back doors and no one is being responsible to give out the information and stuff like that. But in terms of what the Supreme Court has ruled, that also enlightened the issue of how and when and who the transaction should be considered when you're dealing with land in the future.
The biggest issue here in terms of that next set of leases is the massive loss of public assets. It's not just about the value of the land. It's the fact that these are some of the biggest green spaces left in Luganville and Port Vila. And when they go, you can't get them back. That's it. They're developed in various ways.
Dr. McDonnell is quick to praise Minister Reganvanu for starting the campaign to overturn corrupt deals within government. But she's also praising the courage of the judiciary in Vanuatu, who, just as they did in jailing MPs, have shown themselves to be ready to make difficult rulings and build foundations for better government.
It's Richard Hewitt reporting there. The head of Papua New Guinea's Defence Force says the actions of soldiers who gathered to demand answers about money they say they're still owed for working during last year's APEC summit, he says those actions were illegal. Around 60 soldiers temporarily blocked a street outside a government building in the capital, Port Moresby, yesterday. Our PNG correspondent Natalie Whiting was there.
This is the latest instalment of frustrations over APEC allowances for security officials. Police, correctional services officers and soldiers formed a joint security task force for the international event, which was held in Port Moresby in November, and the personnel were all entitled to extra money for the days they worked. Well, shortly after APEC, we saw 300 disgruntled police officers and security guards storm Parliament, angry about the fact those allowances hadn't been paid yet. About 60 soldiers gathered outside Sir Manasupe House, a government office building in Port Moresby. The group was angry about additional money owed to them. After the storming of the Parliament, the Finance Minister committed to giving an extra 300 kina a day to the members of the Joint Security Task Force for their work during APEC. These soldiers say that still hasn't happened. The road was closed and police watched on as the group of soldiers met. The group then did disperse peacefully after receiving a commitment that that extra money would be paid.
Natalie Whiting reporting there in Port Moresby. Well, the head of PNG's Defence Force is Brigadier General Gilbert Toribo. Here's how he responded.
I do not call protest because protest is when people go against a certain policy or against when we are not going to do anything to look after them. But I think it's just a show of force to influence the government to fast-track the payment of outstanding APEC allowances. It's not acceptable. We don't tolerate servicemen who go out asking for allowances. So we will deal with them under the Code of Military Discipline for stepping outside of our normal chain of command.
Head of PNG's Defence Force, Brigadier General Gilbert Toropo.
Pacific Beat.
Well, today is the first sitting day of Australia's Parliament for the year 2019. At the top of the agenda is a bill that would give doctors a greater say over the medical transfer of refugees and asylum seekers from Manus Island in PNG and also those on Nauru to Australia for treatment. The opposition Labor Party, though, is shifting its position on the issue and hasn't yet settled on a final policy, with time running out for negotiations. In a moment, we're going to hear the reaction of those on the ground in Manus Island. But first, here's the ABC's political reporter, Melissa Clark, in Canberra.
In the final days of Parliament last year, the Independents amended a government bill in the Senate with the help of Labor. And if it's approved in the House of Representatives today, it would give doctors a greater say in when asylum seekers on Nauru and Manus Island can be transferred to Australia for medical treatment. Over the summer break, and especially last week, the government ramped up its attack on Labor, warning if the changes do pass the House of Representatives, it would weaken border security. Labor now wants some changes. Shadow Attorney General Mark Dreyfus.
We are going to vote for
the Phelps Bill or the Phelps Amendments. But before that, we are negotiating with the crossbench with some clarifications.
Opposition MPs and senators all met at Parliament House last night for a caucus meeting. They spent 15 to 20 minutes discussing the policy, agreeing to negotiations on three areas: broadening the discretion the Home Affairs Minister would have to overrule doctors on security grounds, extra time for consideration, and to limit the changes so they only apply to those currently on Nauru and Manus Island, so as not to suggest any new boat arrivals could be transferred to Australia.
We want there to be medical treatment available for those in our care, medical treatment that they need, and it has to be done consistently with the requirements of national security.
He put national security at risk. And now a Labor has been forced to crawl back into this position.
That's Liberal MP Sarah Henderson. She sparred with Mr Dreyfus on the ABC's Q&A program last night.
Labor will do anything to unravel border protection in this country.
Okay, frankly, Tony, I need to answer that.
No,
that is
not
a bizarre and disgraceful statement from a member of our parliament. The idea that Labor is intending to unravel
Border protection is nonsense.
Labor needs to find a compromise that leaves the crossbench MPs satisfied, but provides sufficient defence to government attacks it is weakening border security, and that must meet the approval of a caucus subcommittee. There's not much time left. The Senate amendment must be dealt with by the House of Representatives today. If there's no resolution or outcome, only the government will be able to put it on the agenda again, and that's not something the coalition will do. The limited number of days Parliament will sit this year before the election means there's a rush to deal with all sorts of issues. For the 45th Parliament of Australia, it's now crunch time.
It's Melissa Clark reporting there. Well, on Manus Island, asylum seekers and refugees are warning that people are at breaking point. There have been multiple incidents of self-harm and suicide attempts in recent weeks. The medical evacuation bill is also on the radar of the local Catholic Church in PNG. The Papua New Guinea Catholic Bishops Conference is backing it, and it's written to PNG's Prime Minister, Peter O'Neill, about the mental health of the men who remain on Manus Island. Here's Natalie Whiting.
Kurdish asylum seeker Benham Sattar makes regular visits to the small Lorengau hospital on Manus Island.
I met a few guys in Lorengau hospital that one of them hadn't eaten for more than 2 weeks, and for past 4 days he refused even receiving drips.
He says he and others are doing what they can to support those who self-harm.
Everyone is, suffering from mental issues, and the majority are, sleeping with sleeping meds. We have plenty of people who fed up with their lives and just try to end their suffering. It's, it's a very normal thing now.
Hundreds of men remain on Manus Island. Most of them have been deemed refugees. Since the original detention centre has closed, the majority of them now live in guarded camps in town with curfews. Another refugee said he was too tired to be interviewed and instead sent through pictures of a man being stretchered out of the accommodation after a suicide attempt during the day.
There were men over there that are mentally disturbed.
Father Ambrose Pereira is from PNG's Catholic Bishops Conference. The church has started advocating on the issue.
Papua New Guinea is a country that is struggling to deal with the medical issues of its own people. Now, when we have an overload of refugees who have been here for 6 years and are increasing in mental health issues, and Papua New Guinea cannot handle them, I think it is only right that they need to evacuate these men to a better facility.
A new plan released by the federal government includes setting up an inpatient mental health service at the hospital in Port Moresby that treats refugees and asylum seekers deemed too sick for Manus Island. Father Ambrose doesn't think that will be enough. The Bishops' Conference has written to PNG's Prime Minister, Peter O'Neill, about what it describes as the fast deteriorating health situation.
We do hope that we can have a meeting with him to express the concerns of these people, to give them a little voice.
During a recent visit to Papua New Guinea, the Assistant Minister for the Pacific, Anne Rustin, raised concerns that people were being encouraged to self-harm because of the impending crossbench bill. Father Ambrose says people are just desperate.
They see no other way out.
After almost 6 years, many of the men see few options for their futures.
It's Natalie Whiting reporting there. Well, an expert on private security providers says revelations about the company that's been contracted to provide services to asylum seekers on Manus Island highlights the need for greater transparency in the industry. The Australian Financial Review newspapers reported that the Australian government last month extended its contract with Paladin Group by $109 million, meaning it's now won tenders worth more than $420 million Australian for work on Manus. That's despite claims made by Paladin's former chief executive in a legal dispute. The company lodged tender documents that were, quote, misleading, inaccurate, incorrect or wrong. Australia's Home Affairs Minister has refused to release details of Paladin's contracts, saying that they could harm relations with PNG. Dr. Anna Poles from Massey University in New Zealand says that Paladin's being paid a huge amount of money to provide services that have been criticised by both asylum seekers and international observers. She says she was also surprised to read in the Financial Review's report that Paladin has also bought one of Papua New Guinea's biggest private security firms. That's Black Swan. She spoke with Liam Fox.
There is a strong resistance to the private security industry being dominated by international players, and certainly G4S and others have found that out the hard way. So I was really surprised, firstly, that Black Swan had been purchased. It's been the second largest private security company in PNG for quite some time, Guard Dog being the largest. And I was also concerned to hear that Paladin was the company that had purchased it, given their reputation in Manus Island, which has been well documented by UNHCR and others.
What about some of the details of the money Paladin is earning for providing services on Manus?
Well, that seems quite a sizable contract that they have, and certainly, from what I understand, the amount of money that they're being paid is not reflected in the services provided. And that, of course, raises significant alarm bells. And even though PNG does have a Security Protection Regulation Act and a Security Protection Act of 2004, oversight and accountability and transparency is a significant issue in PNG. And it's deeply concerning that an Australian, even though they're headquartered, from what I understand, in Singapore, Australian nationals are able to run a private security arrangement in PNG with very little oversight.
And by the Australian government, it would seem?
A great deal of reluctance on that part to provide that oversight, certainly.
And what does it say about the transparency of private security in the region, do you think?
Well, that's always been one of the biggest issues, and that's one of the reasons why we started looking at the issue around private security, because there is a lack of transparency. And even though there are regulatory frameworks in a number of countries, PNG being one, Fiji and the other, frequently there is a progressive blurring of lines between public security and private security, in which elements of a state are either complicit or the authorities lack the institutional capacity to regulate private security companies and provide that oversight. So it's incredibly important that there are appropriate mechanisms and regulatory frameworks in place to ensure compliance with national and international rules and regulations. It would appear in this case that has not occurred.
Does what Paladin is doing on Manus Island fall within what people would think of as private security? They're not only providing security at these accommodation centres for asylum, but things like food, housing, medical care, though that is debated. Do the existing regulatory frameworks cover those kinds of activities?
Well, no, and that definitely suggests a fair degree of mission creep on the part of this company. We do see private security companies increasingly be involved in non-traditional kind of private security roles. And certainly what they're expanding into in terms of delivery of services raises some serious questions, because these are two very different things as well, providing private security and delivering key services as such as you mentioned. And whether or not this company in particular is well trained and capable of providing those services is highly questionable. And again, this comes back to the need for oversight and accountability on the part of both the Australian government and also the Papua New Guinean government.
It's Dr. Anna Poles from Massey University in New Zealand. She was speaking there with our reporter, Liam Fox. Well, that is all for this half hour of Pacific Beat. But don't forget, at any time, you can listen back to the entire show, also individual stories via our website. You just need to type Pacific Beat and ABC Radio Australia into your search engine to find us. We're also, of course, on Facebook. Find and like the ABC Radio Australia page. We'll be there. I'm Catherine Grau. Thanks for your company.